raising Talion in Velthrin would drag them both into more politics than she was prepared to deal with, at least for now. Once Talion was established as a paladin, then things would be very different. She needed to wait for the right time to strike. He stepped out of the way of the door, motioning toward the handle for her to open it.
I'm not here to bother you about that.
It's the Eighth. She quirked an eyebrow, searching her mind and failing to find the connection.
Looks like one of my spells must have eaten that memory. Either that or I'm just getting old.
The Eighth?
Sorcery measurements?
Ah, right!
She found a bookmark in her pouch, shoved it into the book, and then dug deeper into the pouch for the key to her office. After a few more moments of fumbling, she opened the door and gestured for Talion to go inside.
I suppose we'll have to do it now, then, or the tests will be invalid. We'll have to be quick, though. I have some rather important business to attend to.
Anything I can help with? Talion tilted his head to the side. She shook her head.
Not at the moment, unfortunately. Once I've concluded the preliminary investigation, perhaps.
Once they were within, she locked the door. This wasn't the kind of business she wanted someone walking in on. Talion took a seat in the nearest chair, unrolling his sleeve. Lydia walked around to the opposite side of the table, lifting up her own chair and dragging it over to set it down next to Talion. The swordsman took a deep breath.
Before we start, have you heard anything from Colonel Dyer?
Lydia shook her head. Back in Orlan, Talion had been advised to ask Orin Dyer about Eric Taran, the man who had handed an infant Talion to his adoptive parents. Lydia had asked Orin on Talion's behalf, but Orin hadn't seen Taran in years. At Lydia's urging, Orin had sent letters to a few locations he knew Taran visited, but it was not uncommon for Eric to disappear for years at a time. An expert on travel sorcery, Eric wandered the countryside to learn its features, which enabled him to teleport to a broader variety of locations.
Nothing. He sent a letter to Eric's family in Velraya to ask if they know anything, but it will be weeks before we hear a reply.
Talion nodded sadly. Thank you for looking into it, at least.
It's nothing. Any other questions before we begin?
Talion shook his head.
All right, then. Anything unusual to report?
It was her standard opening question, but she didn't expect much of a reply. Apparently, Velis is a motion sorcerer. Explains how she throws me around like a rag doll. Lydia rolled her eyes.
I already knew that. Anything about your own abilities?
He shrugged. Still stuck at 4 runes most of the time. Occasionally I can get up to 5, but it's extraordinarily difficult. I'm not sure why. In the past, whenever I managed to reach a certain degree of control over the sword, repeating the process got easier. That doesn't seem to be the case anymore.
I'm pretty sure I know why, but we're going to gather more information today. If it agrees with my previous findings, I'll let you know about my hypothesis.
Talion raised an eyebrow. Finally filling me in? You must be pretty confident then.
I was pretty confident 5 months ago, but I hate being wrong. Yeah, I'm getting there.
She put a hand on his exposed arm.
Okay, you know the process. Anything else before I start?
Don't think so. Ready as I'm going to be. He took a deep breath. Go. Lydia closed her eyes, picturing an outline of Talion's body in her mind.
Dominion of knowledge. Measure the flow of essence within his body.
Within her mind, Talion's body began to glow. Networks of lines illuminated a multitude of sorcerous connections. The brightness made it difficult to examine any individual line, but she knew that the spell was attempting to illustrate each of the dominions within his body in a form that she could comprehend. Each line was a different color, allowing her to distinguish between the dominions they represented. Most humans had about 2 dozen visible lines of color within their bodies, representing each of the prime dominions and a series of deep dominions that were essential for the functions of the body. In an ordinary human, these lines typically displayed similar levels of brightness, although there were exceptions. Athletes often had strong lines of motion or stone. Scholars often had powerful lines of knowledge, and artists frequently had brilliant lines of deception. Sorcerers displayed stronger lines for any dominion they practiced, and spells similar to Lydia's were often used to evaluate the potential for talent among students at sorceress academies. These lines would grow stronger through use, like working a muscle.
But, much like with muscles, they could be torn and ruptured, damaging both the ability to use that form of sorcery and other bodily functions. Rethri typically had a single dominion that was particularly dominant, and their other dominions were frequently less pronounced than those in humans. After a Rethri received their dominion bond during their coming-of-age ceremony, they developed a visible pool of dominion essence of that type near their eyes. If Lydia's measurements on Aladir were any indication, this pool grew stronger over time, even when the dominion was not being actively used, making Rethri extremely potent at their own particular sorceress specialties. When Lydia had first examined Talion's dominions while he had been jailed in Orlan, she had detected what appeared to be two dominion bonds. Initially, she had assumed this meant that he had been bonded with a ritual similar or identical to the ones the Rethri used. Having two bonds was rare, but not entirely without precedent. She had heard of cases of powerful Rethri developing bonds to a Prime Dominion and one or more of the Deep Dominions connected to the Prime. A more thorough examination had displayed problems with that hypothesis. His dominion bond to metal was easy to examine with this more advanced spell, but the form it took was perplexing. A Rethri bond looked like a single lake feeding into tiny streams. Talion's was a broad river that began at his right hand and traveled down the length of his arm right before splitting off into smaller streams. His focused source of essence made it easier to draw on if he was touching something directly. The essence source she had assumed was a second dominion bond was even more perplexing. When visualized, it did not look like veins of light at all. Rather, it looked like his body contained several tiny stars, each of which emanated essence that permeated everything nearby. The auras from the stars saturated his entire body, growing brighter every time she observed them. The brightest stars were within his hands, and these were what she observed as Talion began to draw the Sekhes. As soon as the first rune was visible, Lydia watched the lights in Talion's body flicker and redirect essence toward his right hand. From there, she could sense it flowing directly into the Sekhes to power the rune. "Stop there for a measurement. Dominion of Knowledge, measure the rate of essence flow into the Sekhes."
3.2 domini per minute, the spell registered. Almost exactly what I estimated. We'll see if the trend holds.
The sorceress had developed this particular spell specifically for the purpose of this test, since most knowledge spells directed at the Sekhes showed useless results. She had made some progress with identifying the functions of the gemstones in the hilt and pommel, but the blade itself offered no answers.
"Go ahead and power the next rune," she instructed.
She kept her eyes shut, watching the star on his right hand intensify. Most dominion lines dimmed when in use, rather than growing brighter. Even Rethri dominion bonds were no exception. Metal scraped against metal as Talion continued to draw out the blade until the second rune was exposed. He let out a deep breath as he infused the second rune.
"Dominion of Knowledge, measure the rate of essence flow into the Sekhes," she repeated. 10.24 domini per minute, the spell reported to her.
Lydia nodded absently.
"Continue."
She repeated the process for the third and fourth runes, mentally recording the results.
32.78 domini per minute. 104.8576 domini per minute.
The star in his right hand was blinding, its aura extending beyond his arm and halfway across his chest. The other stars within his body pulsed independently, seemingly unaffected by this process. The lines representing his other dominions were gradually fading. They were slowly being drained. She paused, debating if she wanted to push him to continue. The amount of essence he was burning through was absurd by a normal sorcerer's standards, but his breathing seemed normal, and his results were matching what she expected.
"Do I need another data point?" "Not really." "I need to keep my eyes closed. Keep your sword out, but put your left hand in my left hand,"
Lydia instructed. It was a non-standard test, but potentially useful.
"Dominion of Knowledge, measure the uncategorized essence within his left hand."
This spell required two adjustments. One to only measure within his hand, another to measure the unusual essence within the star. She used the term uncategorized because she still had no idea which dominion it represented. Any effort to identify the sorcery type had provided her with nonsensical results.
255.9 Domini.
Lydia frowned at the number.
Disconcerting how much essence he can hold. With that amount of essence, he could power several spells without needing to draw on dominions at all. That would probably kill him, of course.
Keep your right hand on the sword, but put your hand in contact with mine.
That's going to be tricky to do without cutting you. Give me a minute.
Talion pulled his left hand away, shifted in his seat, and she felt the brush of his skin against her fingers a moment later.
Okay, you're touching me.
Lydia nodded once.
Dominion of knowledge. Measure the uncategorized essence within his right hand.
Numbers flickered in Lydia's mind, flickering as they rapidly shifted. One thing was clear in the chaos of digits, however.
He's drawing essence from somewhere else just as rapidly as he's using it.
All right, Solaris, that's enough. You can sheathe the sword.
She opened her eyes, blinking. She could feel a burning in her temples and at the back of her neck, the first signs of a mild overuse of her own sorcery. Talion carefully pulled his hand away from hers, allowing the runes to fade one at a time as he slowly lowered the blade back into the sheath.
I heard some new incants there. What'd you figure out?
Lydia lowered her head into her hands, rubbing at her temples.
Well, to begin with, you're completely unnatural.
We knew that.
Anything with a bit more substance?
You've been keeping me in suspense for months.
He slid his chair closer, putting his hand on the back of her neck and beginning to slowly rub the soreness away. She let out a soft hum of appreciation.
Thanks,
she mumbled. She knew it wasn't a romantic gesture. Talion just seemed unusually comfortable with being physical with people he was close to. When she had asked him about it before, he had attributed it to his upbringing among the Rethri, but none of the Rethri she knew were as tactile as he was. Perhaps the Rethri in the Forest of Blades were more culturally accustomed to physical contact, but she suspected it was more of a personal characteristic of his, possibly even tied to his unusual dominion allocations. Either way, Lydia wasn't going to complain as long as the door was closed. If someone saw them, rumors would be spreading within hours. Which wouldn't be bad, once he was more established. In fact, it might be useful, but she wasn't quite ready for that stage yet.
Right, she paused, focusing her thoughts. I have a hypothesis about why you're having such a hard time igniting that fifth rune. Or a component of the problem, anyway.
Really?
He sounded excited, which was unfortunately rare these days. His happiness level had steeply diminished as the stress of nearing the tests had approached, but she expected that he'd acclimate to the challenges and improve his mood when the testing was over.
So each time we've been doing this, I've been recording the amount of essence you expend on igniting each rune. It goes up every time.
Talion lifted his other hand and scratched at his chin.
That's strange. What do you think it means?
At first, I considered the possibility that the development of other dominions in your body was making the transfer of essence less efficient. I postulated that if some dominions are more compatible with the runes than others, and your dominion balance was shifting in an opposite direction,
the total amount of essence needed to accomplish the same result would increase.
Yes, that makes sense.
He's sharper than I give him credit for sometimes. If he actually bothered to try thinking about his problems instead of brute forcing them, he'd be even more of a force to be reckoned with, which could be dangerous in the long run.
It does, but unfortunately it doesn't hold up to scrutiny. I've measured the changes in your body's dominions over time, too, and while some of them have increased in measurable quantities, notably metal and flame, which I know you practice regularly, none of them have increased in an amount to scale with the increasing costs. None with the exception of the one I can't measure properly, that is.
Ah, my mystery dominion. So you think that it is getting stronger at the same rate at which my efficiency is decreasing?
She nodded. He shifted his chair, moving to rub her shoulders with both of his hands. She let herself sigh audibly as he continued to work.
Essentially, yes, but it appears to be more complex than that. In addition to that dominion growing more dominant in your body over time, I'm seeing something even more unusual. When you're igniting the runes,
That particular dominion seems to draw in more essence from an external source.
That doesn't sound that strange. Don't normal dominion sorcery spells use your essence to call something from a dominion?
Yes, but that's to conjure something outside of yourself, like a ball of flame or one of my barriers. Dominion sorcery doesn't summon anything directly into the body's systems for storing and manipulating essence. Even spells that directly interact with the body do so by changing the body's physical form. They don't put more raw essence into it. The body isn't designed to handle much more essence than it has while at rest. There are a few spells that sorcerers can use to transfer essence to one another, but they're dangerous, especially if the target is already near their essence capacity.
Talion slowed his massaging, apparently distracted by his thoughts. So I'm pulling in foreign essence, which is both unusual and dangerous.
Wonderful. I'm getting less efficient at using the sword because of this strange dominion essence, I take it?
In a sense, but I don't think it's working the way you're thinking.
She paused for a moment, contemplating how best to explain her hypothesis.
You know how the Asharan are supposed to adapt to a dominion the more they're exposed to it, developing a resistance over time?
Talion went still, his jaw tensing.
Yeah?
That's common knowledge.
He still hasn't forgiven himself for that Asharan he killed,
she realized.
I need to be more sensitive about that.
Well, my second hypothesis was that the sword was adapting and developing a resistance. But that didn't make sense. As unusual as your sword might be, I'm relatively certain it isn't sentient, and I've never picked up the dominion of adaptation on it. Nor can I even think of a good reason for someone to build in an autonomous mechanism for it to be resistant to the user's attempts to control it. Granted, your own dominions do grow stronger from the strain, but building an unnecessary essence cost into a weapon is a horrific risk. This sword wasn't made for training. As you've pointed out to me before, it was clearly made for destroying things.
The swordsman pulled his hands away from her back, folding them in his lap.
At first, I thought the runes were a test, something the gods put on the weapon to see if someone was worthy to wield it. If it only gets harder over time, however, that doesn't seem to serve much of a purpose.
Right. So if it's not something philosophical, there must be a practical reason behind it.
I thought about that a lot, and I went back and questioned our assumptions about the runes. We've never been able to identify the rune stones directly, but we know the pommel's gemstone has something to do with the dominion of travel, and the hilt gem has to do with the dominion of insight. The blade's only obvious function is the cutting aura, nothing to do with teleportation or the manipulation of essence like those dominions would imply. I tried looking at the picture holistically rather than just the disparate component parts.
Don't keep me in suspense, Lydia.
I believe that every time you try to use your essence to control the sword, some of the sword's essence is bleeding back into you in the process. Your own essence is gradually becoming more like that of the sword, especially near your right hand. It's not that the dominions in your body are opposing the sword now. It's that they're too similar.
She paused, contemplating how to explain the problem.
When you attempt to control the sword, it's like trying to dilute a liquid, say, mixing water into wine. But every time you do it, some of the wine is getting into your water supply. Now you're trying to dilute wine with something with wine already in it, which is less efficient.
Talion was silent for several moments, glancing down at the sword.
It doesn't make sense. It means that every time I train with the sword, I make it harder to use next time.
He shook his head, resting his left hand on the hilt of the weapon. His expression was grim.
You're saying that my training with this sword has been worthless. Years and years of training.
Maybe I shouldn't have told him about this.
Impulsively, she leaned over and put a hand on his. Talion took a deep breath, closing his eyes.
No, I don't think so. You're building up some kind of dominion in your body. That's something you could learn to control.
But it's possible that my training is going to make it harder to use the sword. I might never be able to control it completely if I keep mingling my own essence with it. And that unknown dominion might have no useful function. We have no way of knowing at this point.
She frowned, but she had to concede the point.
You're not wrong. I'm sorry, Talion.
It's fine. I've managed to ignite more and more runes over time, which means not all of my training was a waste. Just the training focused on the sword itself, it seems.
That wouldn't be a waste either. Just because training with the sword isn't going to make the number of lit runes increase doesn't mean it doesn't have a purpose. It's still strengthening the other dominions in your body, even if you don't value the improvements to the unclassified one.
He lowered his head. I guess you have a point. I've just been so focused on the runes for so long. It's been my only sign of progress. Why would someone make a sword that gets harder to control over time? That seems like madness.
Well,
she said in a tender tone, knowing that this point might be making things worse.
It was probably forged for someone strong enough to use all 7 runes from the first time he picked it up. With sufficient control, the essence might not have bled back into the wielder at all.
Oh. Talion released his grip on the sword's handle, folding his hands in his lap. The God of Blades. Of course. If he could wield it at full strength immediately, he'd never have to worry about training with it.
Talion gave out a hollow laugh. I've been looking at this the wrong way the whole time. The runes were my way of trying to earn the right to use the sword, to prove that I was somehow worthy of having the blade of a god left in my care. How hilariously misguided.
Talion stood up. Thanks for telling me the truth, Lydia. I know you've probably been keeping this from me to protect me, but it's better that I know. Now I can try to plan around it.
The sorceress nodded, uncertain of what to say.
I'm sorry if the knowledge disappointed you, Talion.
She used the title deliberately, and he seemed to notice the gesture, giving her a half-smile.
For what it's worth, I don't think you need the sword to prove if you're worthy. You've proven it to me, at least. I hope you can prove it to yourself.
Thanks, Lydia. I'll see what I can do.
Still bearing an expression of pain, Talion turned and left the office. It was midday by the time Lydia found her way back to the grounds of House Theus. The house guards swiftly escorted her to Nadelia, who she found seated at a small table on a patio on the second floor of the manor. The Baroness wore a fine red dress trimmed with gold, her hair raised into an elegant display. She looked less like a woman in mourning and more like a lady prepared to attend a courtly ball. In her right hand, Baroness Theus held a mostly full glass of wine by the stem. The bottle on the table next to her, however, was quite nearly empty. Nadelia did not turn toward Lydia as the sorceress approached. Instead, she silently stared out over the nearby railing. The sorceress glanced at the nearby house guard, but he simply shrugged. Lydia stepped closer, looking over the railing and finding the source of Nadelia's distraction, a familiar pair sitting at a similar table in the gardens below. Aladir and Nakane seemed oblivious to their observation, staring in rapt concentration at the game board in front of them. Lydia squinted, trying to make out the details of the individual pieces. The game was Crowns, a popular war game among the local nobility. It was asymmetrical, with each player selecting an army that represented a particular faction, such as the armies of a city, or an organization like the Paladins of Taos.
She must like him,
Nadelia noted without shifting her gaze.
Nakane almost never lets anyone win.
Lydia tilted her head to the side, trying to get a better angle to look at the board. Aladir's pieces were bright blue, and she noted several archers on his side of the board. Nakane's pieces were red, but with orange highlights, rather than the gold of House Theus. They appeared to have an equal number of troops still in play, but Aladir's archers had the high ground, giving them the range they needed to fire on Nakane's sorcerers.
Perhaps she's just distracted, given everything your family has been going through.
Nadelia just shook her head.
Nakane is never distracted, my dear. Do you see how she clenches her jaw as she moves that paladin? She knows she is making the wrong move, extending herself needlessly. Aladir knows this as well. That is why he is smiling.
Lydia leaned over the railing, watching the pair play. It was only after several minutes of watching that she grew certain of what she suspected.
Aladir is deliberately making suboptimal moves, too.
But, unlike Nakane, he never stopped smiling.
Do you play, dear?
Lydia glanced to her right and saw that Nadelia was finally looking directly at her.
No, Baroness. It's not an accurate depiction of military tactics, and thus I've never found it useful.
The Baroness took another sip of her wine, frowning.
I don't believe most people play because they're making a study of tactics, Miss Hastings. I believe they find it enjoyable.
Hmm. Lydia pushed up her glasses, which had been slipping down her nose while she leaned against the railing.
Do you play then, Baroness?
Nadelia chuckled lightly, raising two fingers to her lips.
Of course not, darling. Crowns is not a lady's game.
The Baroness turned her head, looking back over the railing.
Nakane, unfortunately, has never been much of a lady. She has always taken more after her father. I'm not sure how to respond to that in a way that would not be insulting to someone.
She seems to be very talented.
Yes, the Baroness nodded. She plays each game on several different levels.
What do you mean?
Baroness Theus momentarily shut her eyes, and then waved her wine glass over the railing.
She plays a friendly game with the son of a man who may have murdered her brother. In playing, she chooses the armies of Blake Hardigan, her father's greatest rival, and then allows herself to lose to the pieces of House Dianis, skillfully chosen by Aladir as a logical army to counter her own.
Lydia frowned.
Is she testing Aladir somehow? Why is she playing the game that way?
Nadelia fluttered her eyes, forming a slight smile.
I haven't the faintest idea, my dear. I don't play crowns.
It was hours past nightfall when Lydia finally found an opportunity to meet with her partner alone. The pair patrolled the grounds, searching for any sign of intruders, as they had each night since the attack. Pairs of guards were placed outside Nakane's and Nadelia's chambers, rotating every 4 hours. Initially, Lydia had pushed for the guards to wait inside the rooms, but the noblewomen both scoffed at the idea.
"Any luck at the Citadel today?"
Aladir asked, his hands tucked into the pockets of his trousers. It wasn't particularly cold by Lydia's standards, but she was wearing a long-sleeved robe, and Aladir almost always wore sleeveless tunics. They were both wearing standard-issue single-handed paladin swords on their belts, and Lydia noted that Aladir also had a dagger sheathed on the opposite side of his own belt.
None. Arbiter Stone remains as implacable as his name implies. He won't even give me a single squad. He said he's lucky we're being allowed to pursue this at all, given that it's not officially in paladin jurisdiction.
Her partner shook his head, his green eyes the brightest thing in the night.
I could try talking to Arbiter Lycelia. She's a friend of the family.
Going to another Arbiter after being denied is a good way to get both of us demoted, Aladir.
Aladir paused in his step, lowering his head.
Kay is dead, Lydia.
You think I care about politics? Of course not, but you should care about practicality. If House Theus wasn't so influential, I don't think they'd even be letting the two of us look into this.
The Life Sorcerer balled his hands into fists.
I hear your words, Lydia, but how can our order turn their gaze aside when an innocent is dead?
The Sorceress sighed, putting a hand on his shoulder.
I'm sorry for your loss, truly, but any breach of protocol is only going to hurt us when we catch the bastard who did this.
If we catch him.
Aladir looked up, turning his gaze to Lydia's eyes. She met his stare.
You're more confident than I am at this point. With each passing day, our chances diminish. We guard when we should hunt.
The city guard is investigating, and they have more manpower than we do. If we find anything that warrants additional resources, I'll ask again.
We're not getting help, Lydia. And we're not helping here.
He jerked a thumb toward the tower where Nadelia slept.
What are we going to do if the assassin returns, using the same methodology as last time? Presume that it was a harvester of poison that we summoned. I'll tell you what we'd do. Die messily.
Aladir withdrew his hands from his pockets, folding his arms in front of him.
We can't fight a harvester, Lydia. But we can fight someone who can summon a harvester. And you're our best chance of finding him.
Lydia folded her own arms.
You're wrong. About the first part, at least.
She reached into the pouch on her left side, withdrawing a large crystal. The Dominion essence of poison that they had found in the ritual area.
If we encounter a harvester of poison, I would throw this at it and run. Then, while it's busy absorbing this lovely crystal, I would gather Nakane and Adelia and flee to the Citadel. Two paladins may not be able to fight a harvester, but you can rest assured the 2,000 would be more than sufficient.
Aladir sighed, unfolding his arms and rubbing the back of his head.
I'm sorry for being so negative, Lydia, but it's been weeks with no sign of progress. I'm sure the city guards are doing all they can, but
protecting the most likely targets for a second attack is more important than catching the assassin, and we are the best chance the remainder of the Theus family has to survive.
Her partner turned his gaze away, clenching his jaw.
Fine. We can stay here for now. But isn't there anyone we can trust to investigate? I'd ask my family, but of course, that wouldn't quite work.
Lydia leaned her head against her hand, considering.
Talion is still in training, and he wouldn't even know where to start looking. Lantan and Veles are in the same position. But I suppose there is someone.
I have someone I can ask, but you're not going to like it.
Hours later, Lydia pressed a letter against a mirror.
Dear Jonan, I know you've been looking for a good opportunity to visit Velthrin. As it turns out, now would be a good time. Lydia.
Chapter 7 Veles 3 Excessive Damage. Veles sat in the stands of the Korenval Coliseum, overlooking the setup of the contest in the arena below. The stadium was the largest in the city and dedicated to Koronir, the god of strength. During sporting events and war games, the Coliseum could seat nearly 20,000 citizens. At the moment, it held a smaller but still intimidating number, more than 1,000 full paladins, several hundred squires and priests, and nearly 500 paladin applicants.
Must be more than half the paladins in the city here. This is going to be embarrassing if I mess up.
She noted a few boxes of private citizens in the stands as well, the majority of whom were probably close friends of high-ranking paladins or nobles who donated significant amounts of money. She saw the banners of House Corvus, the owners of the Colosseum itself, in one of the larger boxes, although not the largest. To the left of House Corvus, she noted another box flying the banners of House Glade, the house of the city's current champion swordmaster, Dreas Glade. She couldn't quite see into the box from her angle, it was too high up, but she wondered if the swordmaster himself would be watching the contest below.
You're thinking, that's dangerous.
Landon poked a finger into her ribs and she playfully smacked his hand. He was dressed in full armor, a look she thought suited him. Freshly shaved and with his hair trimmed short, he was the very image of the perfect knight. In times like this, his persona glittered just as brightly as his mail and served just as well for deflecting threats. Veles knew how to exploit the weaknesses in both of his forms of armor, but she hoped she'd never have to make use of them.
Oh, you know, just looking for any actual competition since there isn't any close by.
Landon raised a hand to his heart, fluttering his eyes.
I am wounded by your dismissal, my lady. Is there any way to treat a man with a higher estimated performance score than yours?
Veles folded her arms, which were just as well armored as Landon's. She wasn't wearing her full armor today, just a mail shirt with bracers and greaves, because they didn't know the details of the test, and she wanted a mix of protection and mobility. If their qualifying event was a foot race, she suspected Landon was doomed.
Oh, you know those scores are bullshit. And you're only 6 points higher than me anyway.
If they're bullshit, why do you remember our exact scores?
Sometimes it's important to quantify the exact values of bullshit. In this case, the delta between my test scores and reality is about 30 points.
So you're saying they should have put you at a 40 instead of a 70? That's very humble of you. I'll make sure to let the testers...
She smacked his arm playfully, then raised her fists and shook them in the air in challenge.
Okay, okay, I surrender.
Landon held up his palms in a defensive gesture.
And I think they're about to announce something.
Finally! We've been waiting for hours, and I'm starving.
On the opposite side of the Colosseum, a portly man stood on a raised platform, dressed in ostentatious robes trimmed with silver. He was flanked by a pair of paladins, but wore no indications of any affiliation with the paladins or priests himself. Veles didn't recognize him.
Most likely one of the people from House Corvus, then.
It took her several moments to realize that he was speaking, and then another moment before a wave of sound sorcery washed over her, carrying his voice along with it.
"Good day, friends, and welcome to our arena! Today, by the grace of Coronir, we will witness a fearsome contest. More than 400 men and women, eager to prove themselves in the eyes of gods and men. Behold, the first of the Trials of Unyielding Steel!"
He clapped his hands, which, with the benefits of sound sorcery, felt like a thunderclap. Velis grit her teeth at the impact.
The man doesn't have a tenth of the presence that Adon did, but at least he's excited to be here.
The speaker looked around, grinning from ear to ear, and then continued.
"I, Aurelius of House Corvus, have the great esteem to preside over this contest. In a few moments, you will see the nature of the challenge."
Velis watched as numerous attendants entered the arena below, beginning to prepare the field for the event. She tightened her jaw when she caught a glimpse of a straw dummy used for archery practice. All of the paladin trainees had some degree of archery training, but it was hardly her area of expertise. When she saw the distance between the targets and where the attendants began to set up the stations with bows and standing quivers, she exhaled deeply.
"Don't be nervous, Vel. You've got this."
Landon patted her on the hand. She let out a light laugh.
"Me? Worry?
Never."
Velis pulled her hand away, clenching her fists in her lap.
"As you can see, this will be a medium-distance archery contest, with a few extra rules to keep things interesting."
Aurelius made a sweeping gesture with his hand, indicating where a second group of attendants were entering the arena. A stream of dozens of people carried armor and helmets, dressing the straw dummies in them. Landon let out a groan, and Velis let herself crack a grin.
"Who's nervous now?"
"Quiet. I'm thinking."
Landon folded his arms. A group of uniformed paladins lined up behind the dummies, placing their hands on the shoulders of the straw men. Velis and Landon watched as the paladins spoke in unison, although their voices were too distant to hear, and blue auras flickered and disappeared around the figures. The paladins retreated from the arena shortly thereafter.
"As you can see, these archery targets are quite thoroughly protected. Armored and helmed like real soldiers, they have few vulnerable points, and even then, they are guarded by a layer of protective sorcery."
The announcer pointed his hand toward an area in front of the archers where a group of attendants was measuring out a line in chalk.
"Applicants will line up at these bows and pick a target. They will be given 12 arrows to fire. After each applicant has shot his or her arrows, they may all cross the line to retrieve them. This is the only time the applicants may walk across the chalk line."
The representative of House Corvus grinned, gesticulating at the dummies.
"But merely firing your arrows will not be enough. You must cause grievous harm to your formidable foes. Each applicant will be allowed a total of 3 flights of arrows. No more. When you have shot each of your arrows, the paladin judges..."
He gestured to a nearby box where Velis could see a few armored figures.
"We'll score you from 0 to 100 points. When all of the applicants have finished the test, we'll reveal the scores. Of 486 candidates, only 40 will pass on to the next stage of your tests."
Velis heard a series of groans and gasps from the other applicants in the crowd, but she wasn't surprised. These tests took considerable resources to run, and she knew the paladins only wanted the best of the best.
"At archery, at least. Bah! At least I don't have to go first."
On their way in, the paladin applicants had pulled numbered wooden wedges out of a jar to determine when they would participate in the contest. Talion had been unlucky enough to pull a 1, meaning he was going to be in the first group below. Landon and Velis had both pulled group 3, so they would be taking the test together.
"One more thing. Before you get too clever, no damaging the dummies while you collect your arrows."
Another series of groans.
"And now, before we begin, I would like to lead you in the warrior's prayer."
Velis and Landon stood automatically, having heard and spoken the prayer hundreds of times. It was one of the most traditional Taos prayers, often being used before contests of battle,
as well as most sports. They each raised a fist over their hearts, symbolizing carrying a sword. As Aurelius began, over 1,000 voices spoke with him, nearly in unison.
Cytira, grant us the wisdom to see the path to victory. Eindarin, give us the skill to fight without equal. Eretar, shelter us from the arrows of our enemies. And Lysandri, give us the strength to shelter our friends. Lysari, let your light wash over our wounds. Coronir, give us the strength to fight again. And Zeracilis, let our battles always be just.
Velis closed her eyes as she spoke the prayer. She did not believe the gods would hear them. That was not why she prayed. Even the most fervent of paladins didn't literally believe that the gods listened to words spoken into the wind. She prayed, as each of them did, to reinforce those values within her and to give her the inner strength to persevere. There was a brief silence as the prayers concluded and many eyes reopened.
First contestants, you may enter the arena!
Velis watched as the first group of 25 applicants entered, still holding a hand over her chest. It was only as Talion entered the arena, sheathed swords swinging on each of his hips, that she allowed herself to grin and return to her seat. Keldon Andis marched right behind Talion, head held high. Rather than armor, he was dressed in a gilded tunic, like he was attending a formal party. His only visible weapon was a long dagger on his left hip. He waved to the crowd as he approached his arrow stand. Keldon leaned toward Talion and whispered something as the pair approached their bows. The latter just shook his head. Velis thought she could see a grin on his face. Very few of the other contestants looked familiar, which was unsurprising, given that there were hundreds of total applicants. Most were visitors from outside the city, but she also knew there were a few classes of paladin applicants that had trained separately from her own. She was looking forward to seeing what they were capable of. But more importantly, she was looking forward to seeing what Talion managed to score.
Contestants! Bows ready!
The archers lined up, drew their bows, and knocked their first arrows.
And fire!
Nearly all of the archers missed. Talion and Keldon both missed badly. Velis lowered her forehead to her hand as she heard hooting and jeering from the crowd.
This could be embarrassing.
11 arrows later, Aurelius called,
"Cease fire!"
Talion's target sprouted a single arrow, barely piercing the right elbow, which was only covered with light mail. Three of his earlier arrows had struck the target, but two had been deflected by the sorceress barrier around it, and a third had deflected off the helmet. Keldon was faring just slightly better, with one of his arrows having pierced the target under the shoulder, a deadlier shot, but still not likely to be instantly fatal to his straw opponent. The pair glanced at each other, and then at their other contestants. At least two of the other applicants had done considerably better. One of them was a young boy, looking like he had barely reached his teenage years. His target sprouted two arrows that had pierced through the chainmail around the neck.
Tirith, she remembered from seeing him in the history class. I had just assumed he was planning to be a squire. Would they allow someone his age to become a full paladin? I suppose I'll find out soon enough.
Contestants, retrieve your arrows!
Velis watched closely as Talion braced his hand against his target's neck, twisting his single arrow to safely retrieve it without breaking off the head. Unconsciously, she rubbed her own arm as the arrow slipped free. After the contestants retrieved their arrows, there was a brief pause as a line of paladins emerged from the opposite arena entrance. They stood behind the dummies and, in perfect sync with one another, recast the protective spells to shield the targets from harm. Velis let out another groan along with dozens of other members of the audience. The announcer laughed.
You didn't think we were going to let you wear the barriers down between volleys, did you? This needs to be a challenge. Now, archers, raise your bows.
This is bad. At least Talion landed an arrow. I don't even know if I can do that much. Landon is going to be fine. He's a good shot. Better than anyone down there right now, and easily good enough to get into the top 40. Sal and I, though, we're going to need help.
You may fire when ready!
Talion didn't fire at all. At first, Keldon didn't fire either, turning to watch Talion curiously. As the others loosed their arrows, however, Talion simply grinned and folded his arms, watching. Eventually, Keldon lost his patience and began to fire as well. When Keldon and the other archers finished, Talion still hadn't taken a single shot. Keldon's target had 3 new arrows embedded within, 2 in the less protected lower body and 1 glancing hit on the neck. He grinned, saying something to Talion. Talion set down his bow, grabbing all 12 of the arrows from his quiver and lifting them together. Then, as the audience watched, he ran his hand across the arrowheads. And then he opened his hand. The arrows shot straight toward his target as a cluster, slamming into the barrier and piercing through it. A cheer erupted from the crowd as the handful of arrows impacted the target, 6 of them embedding into the neck. Only 1 deflected to the ground, and the remaining 5 simply stuck to the bits of metal they impacted with. Talion turned toward her and Landon and winked. Velis rolled her eyes.
Well, wasn't that exciting? Well done, young man. Quite the spectacle. You still have 1 round left, however. Go retrieve your arrows.
The contestants moved to pick up their arrows, Talion walking with renewed swagger. Velis was pretty sure she saw him blow Keldon a kiss. Talion pulled his arrows away 1 at a time, tapping the arrowheads, which seemed to remove the magnetic effect he had placed on them.
Interesting. Is he going to try the same trick twice?
Once again, the applicants returned to their bows, and the paladins returned to the arena and restored the barriers around the targets. Talion readied his bow this time, but Keldon did not.
Begin!
The archers loosed their arrows again, several of which performed better than in the previous rounds. Talion's archery was still subpar. His soul face hit, deflecting off the barrier spell. Keldon had closed his eyes, pressing his hands together in front of him in concentration. As the last of the other archers finished, Keldon raised his right hand, and a glowing golden sword appeared in the air above him. Velis heard a series of murmurs and gasps from the crowd.
The gift of Eindarin. The dominion of blades.
Keldon lowered his hand. The sword shot forward, gold sparks flickering as it tore through the barrier around the target and paused, floating in the air. The blonde-haired swordsman smiled and slashed his hand through the air. The straw dummy's head fell, severed by the golden blade. As the crowd stood and cheered, Keldon opened and closed his hand, causing the golden blade to vanish. Then he grasped all of his arrows in a hand as Talion had, turned around, and carelessly tossed them over his shoulder and past the chalk line.
With all of the arrows past the line, I do believe our first test...
Talion was drawing the sword on his right hip. The sword's vermilion blade reflected in the dawnfire's light, drawing the eyes of the crowd. Talion raised it reverently, kissing the blade, and took a step back. Then, he reversed his grip on the hilt and dragged 2 fingers from his other hand across the blade. The sword's blade ignited with brilliant blue fire. Talion took 2 more steps back, adjusted his grip, then stepped forward and hurled the sword like a javelin. The crowd fell deathly silent as the flaming blade soared through the air. As it struck, the flaming sword penetrated the barrier and continued forward, piercing straight through the dummy's breastplate and all the way through the back. The flames surged and spread, quickly engulfing the entire body. Once again, the crowd rose and cheered.
Wonderful! This is wonderful! I must give my commendations to both of the sword throwers below!
The announcer's gleeful laughter echoed throughout the stadium, amplified by sorcery.
Goodness! I've rarely seen such things, and it's only the first group! Well, the stage has certainly been set. First group, well done, all of you! You may return and let the second group come forward.
Not bad, Sal. Not bad at all. How can I do better?
So, that was interesting. Landon mumbled.
Yeah, we're kind of screwed, aren't we?
Velis chuckled, watching the second group of applicants come forward.
She recognized the Rethri twins, Terrace and Lysen, in the group.
Sorcerers have a huge advantage here. A shame my dominions aren't really ideal for the situation. And Landon isn't a sorcerer at all. A burst of motion sorcery would add a lot of punch to one of my arrows, but I couldn't guide it accurately that way. And there's no way I could throw something that distance. Talion must have guided his sword with magnetism, like he did with the arrows.
When the order to fire was given, Terrace and Lysen didn't pick up their bows. Apparently, Talion had started a trend. Terrace lifted her hands, pressing her forefingers and thumbs together and creating a triangular shape. After several seconds of no apparent effect, a bolt of lightning arced from the cloudless sky and smashed into her target, melting the armor to slag and setting the dummy ablaze. To add to the effect, she launched each of her arrows into the flaming wreckage. She didn't miss a single shot. Lysen, conversely, pressed his palms together, his fingers crossing each other and making a V-shape. Mist rose from below his dummy, growing thicker with every passing moment. By the time the other archers had ceased firing, his dummy was completely obscured. He launched a single arrow into the mist and then discarded his remaining arrows as Keldon had. As the mist lifted, the audience saw the remains of his dummy, frozen solid and shattered into pieces by his arrow. More cheering for Terrace and Lysen. Velis joined half-heartedly, feeling more nervous by the minute. The remainder of the round passed largely uneventfully. There wasn't even enough left of Terrace and Lysen's targets for them to bother continuing to fire. While several of the archers in this group were talented, none of them directly attracted Velis's attention. And then it was her turn. Velis and Landon moved to the staging grounds, where they lined up with the 23 other applicants who would be going at the same time they were. Velis recognized Bertram Colt, one of the somewhat suspicious applicants from Sullier, among her group. Landon brightened as soon as they walked into the arena. He loved a crowd, regardless of the odds. She let his enthusiasm wash over her, and the pair of them waved as they approached the archery stands.
"We've beaten worse odds together in the arena before. Wait. Together? I'm an idiot."
"Archers! Bows at the ready!"
She grabbed Landon's arm as he was preparing to raise his bow.
"Don't fire yet."
Landon blinked at her.
"Okay."
"Archers, fire when ready!"
Landon lowered his arm, raising an eyebrow at Velis. Velis gestured at the quiver.
"Arrows aren't going to hit hard enough to guarantee we win this. And, let's be serious here, I can't shoot for shit."
"No need to be so hard on yourself, Vel."
He glanced from side to side. Some of the archers were watching them, but most were already firing.
"I'm not being hard on myself. I'm being realistic. Hand me your first arrow."
Landon reached into his quiver and retrieved an arrow, handing it to her gingerly. She tapped a finger on the tip.
"You're not the only one who can play this game, Sal. Don't touch the tip. Be very careful. Go ahead and fire it."
The swordsman took the arrow from her carefully, still looking dubious, and assumed a firing stance. Then, after a few moments of aiming, he loosed the arrow. The resulting explosion of concussive force rippled across the barrier, putting visible cracks in the shield and shattering the ground around the dummy.
"Ooh, nice. Let's do that again."
The next arrow shattered the remains of the barrier. The third slammed into the dummy's center, bursting through the mail and embedding in the straw man's chest. The fourth hit the post that was holding the dummy, the explosion shattering the post and knocking the dummy to the ground. The fifth hit the fallen dummy and carried it back another dozen yards, tossing it like a doll. Velis didn't use sorcery for the rest. Landon just shot his remaining arrows at the fallen target. Then the pair moved to where Velis's bow and arrows awaited, and again Landon raised the bow. Velis smirked.
"Let's repeat that, shall we?"
Landon's arrows each struck true, the first two shattering the barrier and the third piercing the dummy's shoulder. The fourth shattered the post, sending the dummy to the arena floor. After that, Landon laughed and handed her the bow. She only managed to hit the fallen target once, but the crowd laughed and cheered when she did.
"Contestants, retrieve your arrows!"
After the arrows were retrieved, the paladins moved Velis and Landon's fallen dummies back into line with the others. Since the posts that held them up were shattered, they simply left the targets on the ground, but once again reinforced them with protective sorcery. Landon walked over to her this time, while the other archers opened fire.
"Okay, Val, that was fun. Any clever ideas for this round?"
"Nothing that wouldn't give away more of my abilities than I want to demonstrate this early."
"Not really. If I thought we could throw our swords accurately, I'd put the same kind of effect on our blades, but..."
"Yeah, I don't think we can get that kind of distance either. You can't control a throw that well with your sorcery, right?"
She shook her head. "I can try to shoot something straight ahead, but I wouldn't even be confident about hitting my target with that while it was standing. Now that it's on the ground..."
"Guess I could just fire off each of our quivers and hope to land a few more hits then. I think our targets are probably in bad shape at this point, but a little more damage wouldn't hurt."
She chuckled at his terrible joke, offering him an arrow. "After you, then." Landon launched another dozen arrows at each target, but with the dummies on the ground, not many of them hit any particularly vulnerable spots. He did manage to put a couple arrows into the area just underneath the breastplates for each dummy, but Velis doubted those were worth many points. As they retrieved their arrows for the last time, Velis glanced at the other targets. One target had been incinerated by a flame sorcerer, and a pair of skilled archers had reduced their targets to pincushions. Bertram, it seemed, was not one of them. His dummy was all but unscathed, and his expression was of shame. Velis felt for him. If she hadn't had Landon with her, she might have been in the same situation.
"And," she considered, "we still might not have done enough. Landon hit the chest on his dummy, which probably counts as a kill, but mine is still relatively intact."
Landon seemed confident. This time, he started firing as soon as the order was given, successfully planting a few more arrows in his fallen target. None of them hit vital spots, but she was convinced the judges would consider his target killed from attrition, if nothing else. When he turned to her, however, she shook her head.
"I've got this one."
He grinned warmly at her, giving her an old Queensguard salute with his left hand.
"This is going to be really embarrassing if it doesn't work,"
she considered, snatching her arrows from her quiver.
"But here I go."
Velis stepped back away from the line, further and further, keeping her quiver of arrows in her left hand. Then, with her right hand, she drew her sword and charged. She heard gasps from the crowd, and she grinned. Just before she reached the chalk line, she jumped.
Surge.
She focused the burst of motion into launching her further into the air, carrying her higher and further, but it wasn't enough. So as she began to descend, she did it again.
Surge.
The essence slammed into her legs, carrying her back upward before she touched the ground, sending her in a soaring arc toward her target, and in a trajectory that would carry her over it.
"Fuck, this is going to hurt. Surge!"
Velis called the last blast of force to push down on her, smashing her downward, her sword pointing downward. As she plummeted, she called on the Dominion of Motion to slowly apply upward force to control the speed of her descent. She landed with a crushing impact, plunging her sword into the dummy's neck as she fell. The force of the fall threw her off her feet, sending her tumbling to the ground in a roll, never losing her grip on the sword. As the crowd cheered, she shuddered on the arena floor, pulling the dummy closer to her by tugging on her sword. When the straw man rolled close enough, she plunged all dozen arrows into its face. And, with the dummy slain, she wobbled slowly back to her feet. After Velis's scrapes and bruises from her encounter with the arena floor had been patched up, she returned to the stands to observe the remaining teams. Talion was sitting next to Landon. He had stolen her seat. She sighed and sat on Landon's lap. He grinned and affectionately tousled her hair.
"That was pretty impressive back there, Vel." Talion nudged her arm.
"I mean, not as impressive as what I..."
"Oh, shut it, Sal."
Velis folded her arms, leaning back against Landon.
"Not everyone has metal sorcery and sorceress swords to lean on.
I told you, this one isn't Dominion bonded. It's just,
a ridiculously rare metal that happens to perfectly complement your already extraordinarily useful skill set."
"Yeah, you both did all right. I mean, it would have been better if you had tried some archery in the archery contest."
Landon chuckled, and Velis stood up, walking to the edge of the stands in front of them and turning around.
"Oh, sure, keep teasing.
See if you get anyone else sitting on your lap.
I'm pretty sure I could get Sal to sit on my lap.
Landon nudged the swordsman sitting next to him. Talion sighed.
You can have my seat, Vel.
Velis put her hand to her forehead.
It was my seat in the first place, but fine.
Talion stood up, making a sweeping gesture of benevolence with his arm.
Please, my lady, forgive